Our gracious God and Heavenly Father, we give you thanks for your grace, as we've just heard of an opportunity to hear next week of living a grace-filled life. We thank you for the abundance of your grace, which comes to us every day in ways that we see, in ways that we don't. Your grace, which goes before us in places that we do not yet know, that we might not even be able to imagine. And that is a great reassurance, particularly as this congregation faces a season of change and transition. I do ask for your grace for this church, for Westminster, that you would see the congregation through, deepening in its faith, strengthening its commitment to you, love for you, and an awareness of your presence and your power in our midst. Thanks so much for this opportunity to learn from the past, from the life and experiences, the thought of John Calvin. We pray that you would be with us in the next hour, that the things that we hear would sink into not only our minds but also our hearts, change our lives, and give us a fresh perspective on how to serve you well. In Christ's name, amen. Well, today, we're wrapping up, and the last couple of weeks we sort of looked in greater detail at Calvin's theology, right? We looked at Calvin's biblical exegesis, his reading of the Psalms a couple weeks ago. Last week, we did a sort of a tour of Calvin's doctrine of election, doctrine of the church, doctrine of the Lord's Supper, and how these things, which we just commonly associate with him, but maybe don't think much more about, were actually derived in contexts where Calvin, as a refugee, ministering to fellow refugees, had a deep concern to help the church map out its imagination as a community of pilgrims in exile, right, in the wilderness. And we do see a rich account in Calvin's theology of the church, theology of the church's ministry and the sacraments, a concern to hold forth the ways in which God meets God's people in this wilderness with God's presence, right? With Christ himself coming to us in the ministry of the word, in the sacraments. Well, today we're going to pull the camera back a little bit and consider Calvin's context again more broadly. Sort of what was going on? What was he thinking about? How did he conceive of his teaching ministry amidst some real pressures that he was experiencing? And one of the things that, again, it's widely acknowledged by scholars, but it's something that it's good to be reminded of, to sort of keep our minds reflecting on from time to time, is that Calvin saw his position in Geneva as particularly strategic for influencing other places, not only Geneva, but also places across Europe, particularly his native France, right, which we've been talking about. He left France as a young adult, about 25 years old, never to return, really. You know, he never really returned for the remainder of his adult life. But he always had France on his mind, right? And we've looked at different ways in which he continued to think about the situation there, particularly those who were suffering for their faith, those who were persecuted for his faith, for their faith. And so today we'll take a look at several topics related to Calvin and his broader context that I think will sort of illumine the ways in which these contexts shaped his theology. So one key shift, right, that happened during Calvin's ministry in Geneva was that sort of the developing Reformed tradition, right, the tradition of which we are a part, right, as Presbyterians, distinct from the Lutheran tradition that developed slightly differently. There's a lot in common, but key differences have to do with sacraments and that sort of thing. But the Reformed tradition, as it developed in its first generation, really developed mostly in Zurich and sort of other Swiss territories. Geneva was a little bit later, kind of a second-generation city coming into the Reformation. And it did take some time for different Reformed communities across Europe to begin looking away from Zurich towards Geneva as sort of a theological leader, right? Looking to Geneva as a place where they would look for guidance, right, from the theological leadership there. So we do see, as we move through the second generation of Reform, a rise in prominence in Geneva's standing amongst Reformed churches across Europe, so that people weren't only looking to Zurich, where Zwingli was in the first generation, Heinrich Bullinger was there later on in the 16th century, but then also beginning to look to Geneva. And that would have an influence on Calvin's ministry. Calvin would see himself as he spent the time in Geneva from 1536 to roughly... he died in 1564. So during that span, he saw his ministry as encompassing not just the local situation in Geneva, but also an international, a pan-European a scope, with churches looking to him and others for guidance. Churches from areas that spanned all the way from England, right in the west, all the way to the east, where you had Poland and other places where you had Reformed communities developing. Geneva also had a pretty wide reach. One of the things that scholars often neglect is the fact that in 1558 we have the first Protestant confession from the quote-unquote New World, right? The Guanabara Confession of Faith. This emerged out of what is present-day Rio de Janeiro. There was a Protestant mission established there. And amongst those who went to establish this church mission in the New World were citizens from Geneva, right? They went with the group to establish this. The reason we have this confession of faith is there's actually a story behind it, right? Within a few months, the leader of the mission reconverted to Catholicism and essentially betrayed those who were with him. Many fled, some were executed, right? And prior to their execution, they were asked to give an account of their faith. So this Guanabara Confession of Faith is a Protestant Reformed confession. It was set into writing in that context, right, where you had individuals who were being examined for their beliefs, and they set forth what was essentially a Reformed account of their faith, their view of the church, their view of the sacraments, and this was then used as evidence against them, right, as they were then executed. So, but you do see the influence of Geneva, you know, as far away as present-day Brazil, right? You sort of see this in the Guanabara Confession. The English Reformation is another place where you see the influence of Calvin's Geneva. As Presbyterians, right, we come out of a stream that passed through England and Scotland, right? That never took hold in England the way that it did in Scotland. The Scottish Church, under the leadership of John Knox, whom I've mentioned before, he spent some time on the continent, right, during the reign of Mary I in England, who was a Catholic monarch. That was a time when many left England and Scotland, sort of the British context. Many Protestants left for the continent to avoid persecution. And Knox was one of those who left. He spent time in Calvin's Geneva, which he called that perfect school of God on earth, right? And so, and he was eager to go back to Scotland and to establish the Church of Scotland in the model after what he witnessed in Geneva, right? With Geneva as the example. So that's how you had Calvin's view of church office, the way the church ought to be structured, taking hold in Scotland as Scottish Presbyterianism. And you also see in England around this time, as these Marian exiles were coming back, many of them came back during the reign of Elizabeth I, who was a Protestant monarch, right? Leading to all sorts of religious debates and contention in the English context. Was the English church sufficiently reformed? If they, in the 39 Articles, the Book of Common Prayer, held forth a sort of reformed theological vision, yet they continue to retain in their liturgy and their structure a lot of things that looked a lot like the Roman Church, right? That's sort of the way in which Anglicanism developed. And of course, you had those who were in the Church of England debating over, well, what does a truly reformed church look like? Right, there are many, and this was the prevailing view that has prevailed to the present day, right, who held that, look, it's possible to be a church that is genuinely reformed and yet still retain bishops, right, sort of this hierarchical view of church government and prelacy, certain ceremonies in our worship, right, which the Book of Common Prayer continued to hold forth, clerical vestments, the way in which clergy had particular dress, right, that mapped on to different things, including the liturgical season. But then you had those who were much more insistent that that was not adequate, that they had to see more change. In fact, they wanted the Church of England to be Presbyterian, right? And so these were known as Puritans. We're not doing a class on English Reformation today, but that represents some of the influence also of Calvin and his thinking in the English Reformation context, where you had various Calvinists who were debating over what it looked like to apply this Reformed theology in that English context. Going back to Calvin's situation, one of the things that was on his mind for 30-plus years that arguably had a deep influence, right, on his theology as we received it, is this notion of Nicodemism and also libertinism. I'll explain both of them as we go, but first Nicodemism. Who were these Nicodemites? What was Nicodemism? Well, whose name do we hear in Nicodemite? Yeah, Nicodemus, right, from the Gospel of John. And what do we know about Nicodemus? Yes, right. So he was a Pharisee, and initially, right, his story is a fascinating one if you follow the Gospel of John, right? By the end, he's among those who are right in broad daylight, attending to the body of the Lord, taking it off the cross, right? But initially, he doesn't want to be associated publicly with Jesus. He goes to Jesus at night. And so Nicodemism was a phenomenon, right, that was named by Calvin and others. Calvin is actually the first one to use the term Nicodemites, which he actually attributes to these individuals themselves. He accuses them of changing their convictions so that they became Protestant by conviction, but continuing to play Catholic, right? Continuing to blend in so that they could avoid hardship, persecution. Essentially, he accused them of denying the Lord, right? Of engaging in idolatry. He has a pretty complicated theology of idolatry that we won't get into fully today, but his argument essentially ends up at the place where even to be present when the Mass is said and the Eucharist at the heart of the Mass is performed, celebrated, which for Calvin and other Protestants was viewed as an idolatrous ritual, right? One that involved the elements becoming the body and blood of Christ, right? They're adored as if they were God. There was a sacrifice involved in that, which again, to Protestants was offensive because we don't offer sacrifices anymore. Christ's sacrifice was sufficient. We receive God's promise, right? Not, there's no need to continue to offer sacrifices to God. Calvin says, even if you're present, merely present there, you're engaged in idolatry, right? Because you cannot separate your external actions from your internal commitments. You cannot, in Calvin's mind, even being present seems to give license to idolatry, which could be a stumbling block to your neighbor. So that's a pretty complex theology that we won't go into full detail here, but he essentially held out two options for those who were in the situation. If you were in a situation where you were compelled to worship this way or face persecution, you had two options. You could either flee, like he did, right? Seek exile, right? Go somewhere else where you could worship God freely in the manner that God prescribed, or you could resist in place, right? Say, I'm not going to do it, and face the consequences, which could range from, you know, ridicule, ostracization by your neighbors, all the way to loss of your work, right? Alienation from your family, persecution, violent persecution, even martyrdom, right? So that was what was going on in France. And Calvin held a consistently hard line against Nicodemism, holding forth only two options, right? It's never permissible just to go along with Catholic worship. For him, you cannot say, oh, this is what I really am inwardly, although outwardly I'm doing this, right? There's no way to separate those two as tidily for Calvin. And so he writes this in one of his treatises that addresses Nicodemism, right? This is his answer to the Nicodemites in 1544. And the quote that I have here is Calvin summarizing the position that he attributes to these Nicodemites, and then giving some thoughts about that position. They keep their heart for God, at least they say so, but they have no difficulty abandoning their bodies to profane and harmful things. Can God be pleased with such a mixture? Can the one who said that every knee shall bow before him and every tongue confess his name suffer anyone to kneel before idols? I also want them to know that it is a great ingratitude on their part that they use the words they take up. And this is sort of a quote that he attributes to them. Since Calvin is so brave, why does he not come here in order to see how he will fare? So this is a critique that he says French Nicodemites have been raising against him. Oh, you know, it's easy for Calvin to say all of this stuff from the safety of Geneva. If he's so brave, why doesn't he come back here and see how well he'll do? And then he says, look, my doctrine's not hard, but it's the hardness of their hearts, right, that leads them to find it so. And there are other places where he addresses this. He says, look, if God required my life of me, I would gladly give it up. I believe that God's called me here to have this ministry by God's providence, and I make no apologies for leaving. But you see, like Calvin is, there's a sensitivity here, right? There's a sense that he continues to need to answer to justify why he left, right, while others remained. To be fair to Calvin, he never said that they couldn't leave also, right? You could certainly leave just like I did. Exile, leaving was always a fair option, but so was coming out and facing whatever might come, whatever persecution might come. The only option that was ruled out categorically was you could not play Catholic to avoid hardship. You could not pretend you were what you are not in order to make life easier for yourself. You had to choose one of these two options. Now, here's the question. Given what we've discussed over the last 3 weeks about Calvin's situation, his concern for France, some of the challenges that he faced in Geneva, how might this campaign targeting French Nicodemism, right, this idea that people in France who were facing pressure to conform to Catholic worship had to make a sharp distinction, a choice, how might that relate to his situation in Geneva? This thing, I guess there are two ways to think about it, right? So if we begin with a French context, and we say, look, you know, Calvin is interested, of course, from the beginning in ending persecution in France, even seeing his homeland turn for reform. I mean, that was clearly one of the things that he had on his heart right from the beginning. He would have loved nothing more than for France to turn to Protestantism. Why would a community like these Nicodemites, whom, I mean, they're intrinsically invisible, right? We don't know who they are. They'd left no records. If they were successful in hiding, right, we'll never know who they were. That's a tricky thing about Nicodemism, right? It's intrinsically invisible. You can't tell what somebody's internal commitments are, if externally they've conformed to all the expectations of the society around them, of the church around them. But for somebody who is hoping for a more dramatic change in the religious landscape in France, why would the existence of this shadowy community of Nicodemites be problematic? I mean, Calvin would want them to stand up. Yeah. Come out. Yeah. You know, like this fence sitting is not doing anybody any good. Right? Like, how is France ever going to change if those who become Protestant just continue to be satisfied with the status quo of playing Catholic, not being willing to stand up for that? And so some scholars have looked at the development of the Reformed Church in France, the Huguenot movement, and sort of seen how there was in cases of martyrdom, Protestant martyrdom in France, you know, many of these individuals were following to its logical conclusion the theology of people like Calvin, of people like Pierre, right, who held forth the same no compromise with idolatry. And they have, some scholars said, you know, maybe Calvin had in mind with his campaign against the Nicodemites, really wanting to push the issue to this, you know, very open confrontation with Catholicism. Maybe even thinking that the creation of martyrs would press the French Reformed Church into a deeper commitment to its identity, a deeper zeal, and it might invigorate, right, French Protestantism. Calvin, of course, died 8 years before the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572, where tens of thousands of Protestants, including many of the key leaders of the Huguenot movement, were massacred, right? So question is, to what extent did Calvin's theology contribute to this, even though he died, right, prior to that? So that's the French context. Why would a message that said to people who are hiding, come out and resist or leave France, how would that benefit Calvin in Geneva? Well, as you remember, go ahead. Yeah, Paul.
Not
much if they stayed in France, but if they came to Geneva, this is another accusation that Calvin had to answer. Not only in his day, but scholars today wonder whether Calvin's attack on Nicodemism might have been intended to drum up immigration to Geneva, right? Especially as somebody who, like we mentioned in previous weeks, was not always popular, sometimes very unpopular amongst his neighbors. He represented this wave of foreign immigrants coming in to Geneva. He was the most prominent amongst the clergy that was made up mostly of French refugee pastors who fled France like Calvin did. That was the majority of the Genevan Protestant clergy. They often did things that were not popular with their neighbors, right? If you could imagine some of the things that they did, the baptismal names controversy, I might have mentioned this, where part of the program that they wanted to introduce as part of religious reform was to wean people away from what they thought were superstitious practices, which included giving saints names or family names, right, as the Christian name to a child as they were being baptized. And so the French clergy, right, the Genevan clergy, who were French refugees mostly, they frequently practiced this kind of provocative ritual where when a child was presented for baptism, maybe with a family name, maybe with a saint's name, one of the most popular names given to a boy in those days was Claude, right? They would say, well, what is the child's name, right? Claude. And then they would say, Abraham. They would change the name as they baptized the child to a biblical name, right? And if you were a parent, you are understandably irked by that, right? You're like, what is this? Like this, and there are riots around this, right? Imagine that, right? Riots around baptism and the child's name at baptism. Well, that was what was going on. As these clergy were doing this kind of thing, there are instances where Calvin was interrupted by an individual, Pierre Amot, who challenged Calvin's doctrine. This individual was eventually tried and convicted of heresy, blasphemy, blaspheming the Lord. He was not convicted by the small council of Geneva. This is a political entity for any sort of offense against Calvin. But in the historical memory, it's easy to connect the two because a small council said, "Okay, your crime was blasphemy, and you in what you uttered in interrupting Calvin at this meeting, the sentence is that you ought to go and apologize to Calvin." Now that was all it was. It would certainly sort of skew things towards a connection with Calvin, but the matter might have ended there, but it didn't. Because Calvin is very sensitive to critique, being critiqued by others, right? And so he felt it was insufficient, the sentence was insufficient, because this was not merely an offense against Calvin as a private individual. This was a offense against Calvin's office as a minister of the church, right? And so Calvin persuaded the council to change the sentence, so that M.O. had to walk through Geneva at night holding a candle in his nightshirt and stop at every major intersection and beg Calvin's forgiveness. Which, the reaction in M.O.'s neighborhood was fierce, right? Who are these people? Who do they think they are, right? And so Calvin, for reasons that had to do with his theology and his personality, both, didn't make a lot of friends, right? And so it was, right, and he didn't always care, right? And so it was, but it would have been much to his advantage to see the makeup of Geneva change with the influx of sympathetic French refugees. And so people wonder, is this whole anti-Nicodemite thing not only about changing the situation in France, but could Calvin have had in mind, right, creating conditions under which it was ideal for people to leave France and come to Geneva. Certainly, whether or not he intended that, it was happening, right? The population of Geneva doubled in a 10-year period, mostly because of refugees coming in from France. In fact, it was something that people wondered in that day, so much so that Calvin addresses it in some of his writings. Like, look, some people are saying that I just want people to come to Geneva. He said, not so. Just go anywhere that you can find worship in a rightly ordered church, right? Pure worship in a rightly ordered. I don't care where you go. But the fact was, many of them came to Geneva, so many that by 1555, right, scholars agree, Calvin was able to consolidate his position. Many of his enemies, his most vocal enemies, were defeated. So that from 1555 on, really his standing in Geneva shifted. So the question is, again, just sort of paying attention to how context shapes our theology, you have this theological argument about whether or not it's proper for somebody to play the part of a different religious confession secretly. But what I've tried to do is show you that reflection didn't take place in isolation, didn't take place in a vacuum, right? That there are actual political and social realities that may or may not have shaped what Calvin was doing. They certainly were on his mind. And that's a good reminder for us about how theology works, right? How we never will write theology that's completely disembedded from our context, because we can never be disembedded from the pressures that we face, the concerns that we have. And one example that we have of this Nicodemite controversy here is Calvin's four sermons of 1552, four sermons concerning matters most useful for our times. This on the surface seems very unremarkable. It's a publication that includes four of Calvin's sermons. They address this Nicodemite controversy with the same message, right? Basically, you need to flee idolatry. You need to resist, even if it costs you your life, or you need to leave and go someplace where you can worship God purely and freely. But, you know, questions come up because these were sermons that Calvin published. These were sermons that Calvin had a hand in revising for publication. And if we are aware of the context and aware of sort of Calvin's own preferences, this particular publication stands out as very interesting because Calvin was vehemently opposed to having his sermons published. He was trained as a humanist, very attentive to literary genre, and for him, a sermon was intended for a particular audience in a particular place, right? A very specific context. Yeah, he wrote his Bible commentaries, he wrote theological treatises and theological manuals with a much wider audience in view. Those are written in Latin. They're intended to be translated. They're intended to resource this church that was spread all over the place so that the ministers who were doing the work of pastoring, right, could benefit from Calvin's scholarship. But his sermons were different. They were preached, right, in French. They were often extemporaneous because he was so busy doing other things, writing his commentaries, giving lectures, that oftentimes when he mounted the pulpit, all he had was a couple notes or nothing at all. He would translate the passage from the Greek or the Hebrew on the fly, and he would preach a sermon. So some wonder whether or not that had to do with why he didn't want his sermons published, because he didn't have as much time to prepare them for publication.
So somebody wrote all that down.
So why do we have his sermons? Right, if he didn't want this. Well, so the French refugees in Geneva, they recognize, look, this stuff is great, and wouldn't it be helpful for our sisters and brothers in places that don't have access to good preaching, in places where they're suffering persecution, to have access to Calvin's sermons? And so they raise money amongst the refugees, right, to hire full-time stenographers to take down Calvin's sermons, word for word, right? And so that's why we have Calvin's sermons. That's why we have Calvin's sermons published. Again, against his wishes, generally, he didn't have any involvement in that. He didn't try to obstruct it, but he didn't, in principle, think that they ought to be, because he felt that something is distorted when you take it out of its original situation, meant for this congregation in front of you, and you try to put it in other places. But yeah, they were spread. This publication is interesting because this is the only instance in which Calvin himself, despite his opposition to this practice, says that he took some sermons that he preached, he revised them, and he set them out for publication. So he was involved in the publication process. And the question is, why? Why would he do this? It addressed Nicodemism, but it was published in French. And one of the things that's so curious about these sermons, if you read them, is that all of those things that he names in other places for why he doesn't want his sermons distributed, like individual references to Geneva and the congregation in Geneva, they all remain there. He didn't edit them out. They're just present. Like he's talking to his congregation in Geneva. So why would he do that? And so some have wondered, you know, whether it's because, again, Calvin might have had ostensibly this controversy in France in view, but perhaps this publication was also meant to target his local situation, right? Maybe his primary readership was intended to be these Genevans. You know, and how would that work? Well, if you read these sermons, Calvin makes this really strong case saying, oh, you need to leave wherever you're facing idolatry, go to a place where you're able to worship God freely and purely under a rightly ordered ministry. That ministry is a gift from God. Now, whose ministry could he be talking about? his own. I mean, he actually addresses this in those sermons. He addresses some people who have come from places, come to Geneva, and who continue to complain because it's not what they think. And again, he says, this is really still God's gift, that you have in your midst a ministry that is purely, that is reformed according to God's word, God's means of nurturing you. All those things I said last week, right? Calvin is holding forth in these sermons, right? And the careful reader will pick up on the fact that everything Calvin says about this ministry applies to his own ministry at a time in 1552 when Calvin's future in Geneva was particularly uncertain, right? There was real strong mounting opposition. It wasn't clear that he would make it through this next set of political struggles, right? He did in the end, but at that point, it wasn't clear. So some wonder whether or not this was meant to address that. This is just a way for us to think about how Calvin's theology, as it came out in different places, could have been influenced by his local situation. Some of those that he might have had in mind were these libertines, right? These people who he called libertines. They call themselves the children of Geneva. Many of them were members of old families, right, who had existed for a long time in Geneva. They were instrumental in bringing Calvin there, in supporting him early on. But they also had a falling out with him at various times, particularly because of the things that he and other French pastors taught or insisted upon that they didn't like, right? Sort of some of the French pastors had a habit of calling out people's indiscretions from the pulpit on a Sunday. Imagine that, right? That could be scandalous, right? Very difficult for you to take if that was coming from your pastor from the pulpit, right? Or things like, resistance to dancing or card playing from the pastors, and these folks were like, I don't know that I like where this is going. Some people were disrupting the worship services as part of their protest. Right? There was one person. I won't even go to what he was doing. It was quite crude, but he would make an audible disruption of Calvin's preaching on a regular basis. As a way of just, again, showing him up. So this was the context with these libertines that Calvin was dealing with. So the question is, he writes this work, he publishes this work that has to do with this lofty theology of idolatry, this concern for, pastoral care and nurture. You need to get to a place where God can feed you. But then you kind of wonder how much of that also is wanting to address this opposition. And I think for us as historians, it's important for us to take into consideration all of these possibilities and allow for the fact that as complex people, sometimes we're motivated by all of them at once, right? It's reductionist to say it's either just purely theological motives or political motives, but I think we can relate to the fact that wherever we are, we're always motivated by a complex amalgam of pressures and influences, and Calvin's no different, right? So, but I think naming these things help us to appreciate how his theology was an example of ideals, right? Striving towards ideals, but doing so in a deeply embedded situation, right? Your ideals are shaped by your circumstances. One significant example that I want to draw our attention to as we move towards a conclusion is Calvin's continuing engagement with his homeland, right? Did Calvin's understanding or imagination with respect to France develop over time? So in 1536, remember we talked about how even the institutes had France in view. 1536, right, Calvin talks about how he wrote the Institutes in part to vindicate the cause of French evangelicals, French Protestants who were being persecuted for their beliefs. He writes this in his prefatory letter to King Francis I. This was appended to the first edition of the Institutes, and it continued to be published with every edition of the Institutes subsequently. Calvin writes, "For this reason, most invincible king, I not unjustly ask you to undertake a full inquiry into this case." So he's like, "King, this is what's going on. People are being persecuted, killed even for their beliefs. You really need to take a look at this closely. Do not think that I am here preparing my own personal defense, thereby to return safely to my native land." So he names the fact, "Hey, I'm not there. I am in exile. But this is not my ploy to guarantee like a safe return home for myself. That's not why I'm writing this. Rather, I embrace the common cause of all believers, that of Christ himself, a cause completely torn and trampled in your realm today. For ungodly men have so far prevailed that Christ's truth, even if it is not driven away, scattered and destroyed, still lies hidden, buried, and inglorious. Meanwhile, no one comes forward to defend the church against such furies. It will then be for you, most serene king, not to close your ears or your mind to such just defense, especially when a very great question is at stake: how God's glory may be kept safe on earth, how God's truth may retain its place of honor, how Christ's kingdom may be kept in good repair among us." So, Calvin, from the beginning, has a concern for France. He names for the king, "Look, these Protestants, these evangelicals, are being unjustly maligned by those who, as they exercise their influence, are doing nothing less than taking Christ's honor, Christ's glory away, trampling it, hiding it. King, it is your responsibility to attend to this, right? To address this injustice." So Calvin's mind is on France. In 1557, 21 years later, he writes his preface to his commentary on the Psalms, which we looked at 2 weeks ago, and he looks back on why he wrote his Institutes, and he basically affirms what we just read, and he adds another reason. "This was the consideration which induced me to publish my Institutes of the Christian Religion. My objects were, first, to prove that these reports regarding heresy and immorality of Protestants were false and calumnious, and thus to vindicate my brethren whose death was precious in the sight of the Lord." So that's the first part. He just basically said what he said earlier. "I wanted to make clear that those things that were said about them, that they were heretics, they were immoral, were not true. I wanted to vindicate them. I wanted to give a full account of their theology. And next, that the same cruelties might very soon after be exercised against many unhappy individuals, foreign nations might be touched with at least some compassion towards them." So, again, he says, "Another reason that I wrote the Institutes was not only to vindicate these individuals by giving voice to their theology, but I also wanted to draw attention to their plight so that maybe foreign nations would be moved to intervene on their behalf, right, or to pay attention to what's going on there." So you see, even over this 21-year period, Calvin still envisioned his Institutes as having a relation to France, even though he was in Geneva. Yeah, on the map, Geneva's right outside the boundary of the border of France, but they couldn't be further apart in terms of their commitments, right? Geneva was a reformed city. And Calvin, as you see through these quotes, continued to have his mind drawn towards France on a regular basis. That would be translated into action. In 1555, 1556, he began lecturing through the Minor Prophets of the Hebrew Bible. He had a weekly lecture series on the Minor Prophets where he would have a number of people gather every week listening to him lecture through this portion of the Old Testament. And what we know about the makeup of that audience was that many of them were ministerial students training for the ministry, as well as French refugee pastors right? Pastors from the Reformed Church in France who fled France. And what was Calvin doing? Well, Calvin was training these individuals in biblical interpretation, right? He was giving these lectures on the Bible with a goal towards, at least for some of these pastors, sending them back into France. And we know this, right? This is sort of, he was sending them back in as sort of underground, clandestine missionaries, right? To go and to serve this church of, this Reformed church in France. And what was Calvin teaching them? Well, when he was reading through the Minor Prophets, he was essentially developing this idea of two churches, like what some scholars have called a two-church theory. If you read his Institutes, he talks about a true church and a false church, both of which have the name church, but only one of which is truly the church. The other bears that name illegitimately. If you were to guess who he had in mind when he thought about that illegitimate church, who do you think? It was Rome, right? So he talks about how Rome, in departing from the Word of God, in distorting, corrupting the sacraments, has basically given up, right, their right to call themselves church. Calvin goes into the Minor Prophets and he says, actually, we learned this theory here, because we see back in the ancient times of ancient, the context of ancient Israel, there was this Israel that had been polluted, corrupted by turning to the idolatry of these foreign nations under which they were held captive or by which they were influenced. And so that's what the prophets were all about. They were about calling forth a remnant, right? A true Israel, a faithful Israel. And so for Calvin, what you see going on, these Calvin's lecturing to this audience of students, right? What you see going on here is God addressing two groups that both claim the name Israel, only one of which was faithful, only one of which was God's faithful people. And so how would that map onto Calvin's present circumstances? Well, you had the Catholic Church in France, you had the Reformed Church in France, right? One was sort of the larger body, the corrupt, illegitimate body who had given over to idolatry. The other was the smaller yet faithful remnant. And who is Calvin, right? Who are the prophet, right? Who addresses both, right? But he's calling forth greater faithfulness on the part of the smaller remnant. This was a theology that he was using to help these pastors imagine their situation as they were going to go back into France and kind of to map the various groups that they were going to encounter on this sort of biblical narrative imagination, right? Who were they? How do we think about them? So Calvin's lectures on the Minor Prophets, again, an example of Calvin thinking about his context in France. Now, the last example I want to raise here is very interesting, and this has caused no small amount of controversy amongst Calvin scholars. So these are the very last words of the Institutes. The non-bolded type had been part of the Institutes from the very beginning, from the first edition, 1536. Right, the bolded type is introduced for the first time in 1559. Actually, the second paragraph is introduced in 1559 rather. The bolded part I highlight because I want to emphasize this at the end. So in 1536, and this carries over through all the editions of the Institutes, Calvin writes, "Suppose, however, that the whisperings of the malevolent so fill your ears that the accused have no chance to speak for themselves, then we will be reduced to the last extremity, even as sheep destined for the slaughter, and may await the strong hand of the Lord, which will surely appear in due season, coming forth armed to deliver the poor from their affliction and also to punish their despisers, who now exult with such great assurance. Okay. I misspoke. This 1536 excerpt is actually from his preface to King Francis I, which I read from earlier, where he said, "Look, King, it's your job to look into this matter, to act justly, to attend to the concerns of those who are being unjustly persecuted for their faith, to intervene, right?" And then he says here at the end of this preface, "If you don't, we are still confident that God will one day intervene. We don't know when, but God will make all things right. So our confidence is that even if you don't turn, if you're not persuaded, if you continue to let these malevolent voices influence you, God will hear the cries of God's people. God will intervene. And we will wait patiently for that." Now, the second quote, what is this? Like I said, okay, so the unbolded portion appeared in 1556. The bolded portion was added in 1559. These are the very last words of the Institutes. "The Lord, therefore, is the King of Kings, who, when he has opened his sacred mouth, must alone be heard before all and above all men. Next to him, we are subject to those men who are in authority over us, but only in him." So what's that saying about kings and princes and queens? That, yes, we acknowledge their authority, but we only submit to them as those who are subject to the Lord. "If they command anything against him, let it go unesteemed. Let us not be concerned about all that dignity which the magistrates possess, for no harm is done to us when it is humbled before that singular and truly supreme power of God." So we shouldn't be overly impressed with worldly expressions of power, right? We ought to think of them nothing when we think about them in comparison with God's authority. "On this consideration, Daniel denies that he committed any offense against the kings when he has not obeyed his impious edict." Right, this is a quote. This is a reference to Daniel 6. "For the king had exceeded his limits and had not only been a wrongdoer against men, but in lifting up his horns against God, had himself abrogated his power." Okay, so what's going on here? Actually, I misspoke again. This 1559, this entire excerpt was added to the Institutes in 1559. So what's the difference? 1536, Calvin is saying, look, if you don't intervene and do the right thing, that's okay. God is going to judge you, and God will make things right in God's time. We don't know when that's going to be, but that's where our confidence is. By 1559, what has Calvin articulated? That look, if you don't do the right thing, you've abrogated your power, and we are no longer obligated to obey you. Right? Let the monarch, let the authorities, dignity and commands go unesteemed, right? We don't have to listen. Why? Because he has exceeded his limits. In lifting up his horns against God, he has himself abrogated his power. So the debate among scholars is Calvin advocating for some sort of a rebellion, resistance, revolution in France? Yeah, he doesn't quite go so far, but he certainly opens up room in his theology for that in a way that hadn't occurred there before, hadn't been present there before. And of course, Calvin would die 5 years later. He would not actually live to see the outbreak of, the continuation of, the French Wars of Religion, French Civil Wars, between those who were his theological followers, right, and sort of the the majority Catholic culture in France. But it's interesting to sort of see how Calvin's theology and his concern for France seem to evolve over time as well. And that just in closing, that ties a bunch of themes together for us. Right? It reminds us that, like I've been saying all month, that theology is never done in a vacuum. Right? That as we go back and we appreciate the theology of those who have gone before us, of those who continue to speak to our tradition, who resource our tradition, and we've looked at some lofty ideals, some beautifully expressed thoughts with respect to God's kindness and beneficence and nurture in the Psalms, through the sacraments, in Calvin. These are things that we rightly are nourished by, right? That rightly stir our imaginations, right? That rightly inform our piety. But as we began a month ago right now, with Heiko Obermann saying, we shouldn't be content with the Geneva burger, right? That the theology that we so appreciate emerged out of a concrete context that shaped it, that gives it its depth and its power. We see that when we begin asking questions of what was going on around Calvin during this time, we see Calvin just like us, enmeshed in all sorts of stuff. Right? Pressures, concerns, things that pulled him one way or the other, things that made him maybe less consistent than we would like him to be on certain topics, right? And I think that then, I think, helps us to pause and reflect on two things, right? One is that we always want to be concerned for context. We always want to be asking not only about the ideas themselves, but the situations out of which those ideas emerged. And secondly, we also come at this kind of study of the historical past with a deeper appreciation of the things that we hold in common with those that we study. Even those whom we esteem and we tend to hold up as maybe even set on a pedestal, right? Like someone like Calvin in the Reformed tradition is generally held in pretty high regard. But yeah, tell you things about some of the things that he did, some of the maybe his political motives for saying this and that. That might cause him to lose some of his luster in our imagination. Yet, I think the real cash value of that is that he becomes more relatable. That he, like us, was struggling to balance a number of realities. Right? How to be faithful to his ideals, how to be faithful in his reading of Scripture, how to be faithful to the God to whom he answered, yet at the same time trying very hard to read his circumstances well and to read them wisely, sometimes doing a great job with that, sometimes doing not so good a job. And I think the more that we realize that about those whom we study and engage, right, through our looking at the past, I think it can be also a great comfort to us in the present, right? That they are part of our community, that they are shaped by their were shaped by their circumstances the way that we are. And so as we engage them knowledgeably, we engage in a Catholicity that extends not just across every tribe and tongue and language and nation, but also back across time, right? Calvin becomes a conversation partner, a relatable conversation partner for us in the present. And so I hope that this month has helped to make him more accessible to you, hopefully stirred some interest perhaps to read further in Calvin. If you have any questions about anything we've talked about, my email is on every week's handout. You can always access me. You have a question today? I'm happy to answer. Yeah. Yeah, so the Protestants were in a significant minority. So I don't have the exact numbers, but it might have been like 10% or even fewer. But for different reasons, there were very influential people early on who turned to Protestantism, even within the royal family. So that created a situation in France that was less like Italy or Spain and Portugal, where you had a dominant Catholic culture that did a very good job sort of just systematically controlling everything. Because of the way Protestantism took hold in France, it was still a dominant Catholic culture, but there was this, you know, strange tolerance of this Protestant minority that led to the outbreak of war and resolution through truces that nobody was satisfied with, that continued to build tensions in that place. So that's a great question.
Yeah, Ted. How might we put Calvin's thin skin in context?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I'm, you know, as a Calvin scholar, I'm deeply appreciative of Calvin and his ideas, but it's one of these things where, you know, we want to be good historians and take the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think Calvin's thin skin is very much... So Bruce Gordon, a Yale scholar who's written, I think, the definitive biography of Calvin, uses this term to describe Calvin's anger at criticism. He says that Calvin was at times incandescent with rage. I mean, he didn't take well to being critiqued. But this was the same Calvin who insisted that he be buried in an unmarked grave, not to diminish any, right, from God's glory. And this, Gordon, I think, makes a compelling case for arguing that Calvin struggled with this all his life, right? Knowing that, well, having the sense, he's the kind of guy that he's entered a room, quickly had a sense that he was the smartest guy in the room. But because of his theology and his desire to give all glory to God, he was aware of that, and he was very concerned with pride and with humility. And so I think, to put it in context, right, in an edifying way, I think what we see is a complex individual who knew things about himself, who maybe as he saw those things about himself, they informed his theology and made him all the more concerned with our recognizing our proper place before God, because that's something that he struggled with. And I think that too, if we put it in context, makes him more relatable rather than less relatable. And so... that's a great question. Any final questions? We're over time now. Last question. Okay, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate spending time with you this past month.